Hello and welcome to episode 123 of the Blue Cup Tools podcast. I am Francisco Gonzalez, also known as Grundislav, and with me, as always,
I am Ben Chandler, also known as Ben 304, which are the other six numbers that go along with 123. It's just not quite in that order.
Did you have to remember who you were there for a second?
It took me a while.
There was a brief pause.
This is the only time I tell people my name. I don't walk around and be like, hi, I'm Ben Chandler, also known as Ben 304.
Well, that's also because you live in a town of like six people, so everyone knows who you are.
And together we are at...
No, that's at the end.
Oh, see, this is how badly discombobulated I am.
Yeah, it's fine.
This does not bode well.
How have you been since last we podcasted?
Confused, apparently.
Clearly.
And how about you, Francisco?
I've been in a state of general malaise.
Why?
I'm kidding. I just wanted to be dramatic. No, I've been fine. I've been working on my game. I've been... Let's see. I attended the Neuroscope conference.
Their first conference?
Yes, their first conference.
The inaugural conference?
Yeah. It was very well put together and very well organized for being a first conference, which sounds more insulting than it should, but I mean that in all sincerity.
It's not a bad idea to go in with hedged expectations, I think.
Sure. I mean, I had the impression based on it had been brewing for a while. I mean, I remember first seeing flyers for it at GDC 2017, I want to say. Or maybe 2018, because I remember it seeming like, oh, 2019, that's a while away, but also not that far away. Anyway. Yeah. Andrew Plotkin, also known as Zarf, in the IF scene, had been circulating some flyers at GDC 2018. And so, yeah.
Okay, so it was kind of a year or more in the making.
Yeah, and so they had their registration, they had their submissions thing. It was all done pretty quickly, and it was held in mid-June at MIT in Cambridge, which is the greater Boston area.
Not like the UK Cambridge.
No, Cambridge, Massachusetts, United States.
It does get confusing driving around the roads of America and seeing, you know.
Well, that's just because none of the colonists were creative and they were just like, let's just call this new old city name or call it exactly the same city name as what we left behind. See, if
Australia
I wanted to.
Is not that different.
Well, no. But if I wanted to live, or if I wanted to escape my religious or whatever persecution, I wouldn't want to be reminded of the place that I left behind. Although I guess...
Well, I think being reminded of the place...
Yeah, that's true.
Escape the people is two different things. Like,
no, you're right.
You can feel
right.
Nostalgic for your home while also running from, you know... Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah, I mean, if I went, you know, if I moved to middle of nowhere Australia and was next to a beach, I'd be like, I should call this place Miami Beach. Oh, wait a minute, somebody already did that.
I mean, it's hard enough naming a game, let alone a whole place.
That's absolutely true.
So, I feel like...
Anyway, that derailed into a major tangent. No surprise there. But anyway, yeah, Neuroscope was good. I hope they are definitely doing it again. I hope they do it in Boston again. And I highly recommend people go. Lots of people actually there was a bit of overlap between like people who go to Adventure X and some people who go to the Adventure Party at GDC.
Right. Well, I imagine it's mostly because it's narrative focused that is sort of tailored to their ideas and things.
Absolutely. But yeah, it was cool. It was cool to see that. And of course, there was a lot of new faces and stuff. So yeah, hopefully it'll gain some traction. I mean, it was pretty well attended. I think they said that there was about 250 registrations and about 230 something people actually showed up. So that's not bad for a first year conference. And like, even though it was three tracks, so there was always three talks going on simultaneously, the lecture halls seem to be pretty well filled, so.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's really the only major bit of interest that's happened to me over the past few months. We don't podcast very much anymore, but I like to think
we really don't.
I like to think that it's quality over quantity. Because
there was a time when we were just sort of like, you know, turn the microphones on and like not really have that much to talk about.
Isn't that all the time?
Well, true.
But we actually do have stuff to talk about today.
Yeah. No, I feel like now when we do it, we're like, oh, hey, you know, this something happened. You know, not just like, you know, oh, well, we should podcast. It's time to podcast. So let's do
right.
that.
Right, right.
Which, you know, yes. I think that's cool. As you say, quality over quantity. I don't know if anybody actually likes the sound of us talking. I think they actually want us to say something when we do it. But who knows?
I mean, this isn't an ASMR podcast. They're not here for the sound of our voice.
No, I'm not going to like...
I'm going to take care of you. You have the plague.
That was a terrible, terrible video.
I know, but it was supposed to be terrible.
Well, I guess.
For those of you wondering, go check out, there's a parody ASMR account on YouTube. I don't remember what her name is, but if you look up...
You found her, it wasn't me, I don't remember.
Oh, I know. But if you look up ASMR Plague Nun, that's one of her characters. She dresses as a bunch of, like, she does, like, really random, bizarre historical ASMR. One of them is that she's, like, a 13th century nun taking care of you while you have the plague.
I do want to say that if you are looking at this, maybe check your priorities and don't do what we do and have terrible
Don't priorities. Judge our listeners. They're listening to this podcast. They obviously have taste.
Yeah, they have something.
Yes.
Hey, listen. Yeah, anyway.
Anyway, so you went back to Australia. What have you been up to?
I am in Australia. I've just been catching up on stuff. Hmm. You know, I was away for a while and I was pretty busy catching up with people and catching up with staff and, you know, just sort of, I haven't gone out much. I haven't gone to any shows or anything much. I've been kind of quiet after my big trip, but that's normal. Hmm. You know, you come home, you kind of collect your thoughts.
It takes time to recover.
Yeah, it does. And also usually like I have, you know, my schedule booked up with stuff, but obviously when you go away you can't really book stuff up, so I kind of just have been not really doing that much, but I've been enjoying life and working away on projects and stuff like that. I finished Myst.
Oh, I've never played Myst.
I didn't need a walkthrough, and it's weird because when I played Myst as a child, I really thought it was interesting, but I couldn't even find a puzzle, you know, and I thought, man, how has anyone solved this? This is ridiculous. And then I just, someone was playing it on Twitter that I follow, and I thought, man, I haven't played Myst since I was a kid. I should just fire it up and click around it for half an hour just for a laugh and not solve anything and, you know, uninstall it again. That's how you play Myst, right? And then I was like, oh, there's a puzzle. And then finding that one puzzle led me to another puzzle, led me to another puzzle, et cetera, et cetera. And before I knew it, like, I finished Myst in, like, a day or less.
Hmm.
I was like, oh, huh.
Well, good.
Turns out it's really easy. So then I installed Riven, and I was like, oh, well, if Myst is easy, then Riven will be easy as well. That'll be fun. I'll install that. I still haven't finished Riven.
Hmm.
And I have, like, 4 pages of notes, and I have spent countless hours walking around. That's a tough game, man.
Hmm. Yeah, I haven't played any of the Myst games, but I did get the impression back in 1997 when I convinced my friend to stop playing Riven so that we could play The Curse of Monkey Island that Riven was much harder than Myst.
Oh, yeah. It's weird because depending on who you talk to, people will say, oh, no, Myst is much harder or Riven is much harder. So I'm not sure if it's like, you know, the thing that got me stuck for the longest on Riven was one of those, you know how particular games have infuriating things that you've missed and you're like, I can't believe I missed that.
Maybe. Probably.
Yeah. Well, you've played adventure games, you know how it is. Sure. And you're stuck for hours and hours and hours and then it just clicks.
Oh,
and sometimes you feel like it's fair and sometimes you feel like it's not. Well, in this case, I didn't quite feel like it was fair. So that's a little...
Hmm.
Just, you know, But that's what I want.
Hmm. Okay. Well, good.
Well.
Well.
Not really, but, you know. I still have, like, hopes of finishing it, but, like. But, well, you know, like.
Hope's always a good thing to have.
Yeah, I just needed a break, you know. They got to a point where I'd just been, like, doing it for so long, and I was just like, oh, man. All right, I really just. I could do with a break from this.
Hey, you know what would be a good game to play in the meantime while you take a break from Riven?
I'm going to give you a big fat Conquest of the Long No.
You are the worst! You really don't know what you're missing. A mutual friend of ours recently played through Quest for Glory 4 and was like, oh my god, I can't believe that I always was saying that Quest for Glory 3 was so great, and I didn't know what I was missing, and I feel like you would have that same reaction to Conquest of the Longbow.
I mean, I know that you hate...
Yeah, but they're two completely different games. It's not like it's oh, I liked Leisure Suit Larry 2, or I didn't like Leisure Suit Larry 2. Maybe I'll like Leisure Suit Larry 3. It's a completely different character. It's a completely different setting. It's a completely different story. It's like, you know, you felt like you were going on a king's quest in Conquest of Camelot. You're not going on a king's quest in Conquest of the Longbow. You're Robin Hood, and you're trying to raise money for a king.
Okay, I just...
It's a Kickstarter quest.
So many Sierra games at a time. You know that.
I know that, but when was the last time you played a Sierra game?
Too recently.
Yeah, when was that?
I honestly do not remember.
See?
The last Sierra I finished.
It's been so long that since you played an adventure.
You know what it was?
Was it Lost Sequit? Oh, wow. Well, if it was Torrent's Passage, then of course you're put off.
That's what put me off, yeah.
Yeah, but...
Everyone good.
But Torrent's Passage is an Al Low. I know, we've established this. Torrent's Passage was an Al Low mid-90s adventure, whereas...
Midlife crisis.
Whereas Conquest of the Longbow was early 90s Christy Marks, and Christy Marks is one of the most underrated Sierra designers, in my opinion.
Okay, well, what else did Christy Marks design?
Conquests of Camelot.
Mm-hmm.
She only did two games for them.
Oh, well.
But they're both very good games.
It's not a big surprise that she's quote-unquote underrated, though.
Well, because...
They're not two of the more well-known games. In fact, I had honestly never heard of Conquest of Camelot until I got given a copy.
Yeah, well,
so
there you go. Anyway, if you have not played Conquest of the Longbow like Ben, please reassess your life. And go and play Conquest of the Longbow. I will say, as all Sierra games have a caveat, I've said this before, I will reiterate, that there are several bits that rely on the copy protection to get you through.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like even I knew that, and I don't know anything about Sierra games. So.
Yeah, but I mean, it's just a matter of, you know, having it next to you. But it's not like, type in the third word of the fifth page on the thingy-majig, you know? It's like, remember, okay, so you know in Conquest of Camelot at the beginning when you're at the...
Sure.
When you're in the forest.
Yeah, I had to enter the thing three times from the thing, if I remember correctly.
What thing three times?
Like, stuff from the manual.
Oh, right, but I mean, I'm just saying, like, there's that bit with the riddles, the riddle stones.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of how they incorporate it. Like, there's a bit where you have to prove your knowledge of gemstone lore, and so they give you riddles, and you're supposed to, like, reference, because it tells you in the manual what each gemstone represents. And so
didn't I help you with the riddles in Conquest of Camelot over Skype?
Did you? I don't remember.
I feel like it.
Maybe
you were playing and reading them out, and I was helping.
Perhaps. Anyway.
Riddles are my kind of thing, because I like 1990s role-playing games, and they have so many riddles in them.
Yeah, I like riddles, but I don't like the riddles where it's like, oh, maybe this word means this other thing, and then that is the thing. Like, those are two.
You know what? If you're getting a riddle in an old game, it's probably death, time, or the wind. That's like
The wind.
I'm not even joking though, seriously. Like, if you're...
There's one riddle in Conquest of the Longbow that always gets me because I never know what it is, and the answer is cheese.
Okay.
Because it's...
But yeah, like, the yeah. amount of times that I've had ones that...
You have to... Like... You have to sort of be familiar with how to make cheese to get that riddle right.
Oh, do and... you have to put, like... Is it about rennet?
No, it's something like... I forget what the riddle actually is, but...
I'll discover the riddle for myself in 2024. I'm looking forward to it.
Really? I'll be dead by then. I want you to play Conquest of the Longbow before I
mean, you'll be dead by 2021, too. It's not
gonna happen. Wow, wow, wow.
I'm trying out Dark Humor Me.
Oh, you're trying it out. I see. Yeah. Anyway. Hang on. I'm actually looking this up because I want to know what the riddle is. I forget what day you have to talk to the guy. Oh, here we go. It's not born, but from a mother's body drawn. Oh, what? That's just an ellipsis.
That's milk.
Yeah. And then it talks about, like, how it, how the thingy-majiggy thingy made... I'm sorry.
Wow. Curds and whey? Culture?
I'm talking about how it makes... How it is made.
Do you remember Trevor?
Yes. Of course I remember Trevor.
He used to make a really good camembert.
Oh, really?
Mm.
Interesting.
And like... yeah.
No one on this podcast knows...
No, knows who Trevor
who
is.
Who Trevor is.
It wasn't for their sake, it was for your sake.
Well, thank you, I appreciate it. This is why we don't have listeners.
They get enough from us, Francisco. They get enough from us.
Fair.
What more could you want?
I don't know.
But Trevor was a cool guy. Well, I mean, he's not dead, he just moved.
Okay, see, I get worried. I get worried when you talk about him in past tense because Trevor's...
Yeah,
Trevor's
had a lot of health issues.
Yeah, Trevor's almost died like 50,000 times, so it's...
Well, I remember... I was at a barbecue with a bunch of us, and we were just chatting away, and I was like, how many surgical procedures have you had? And he was like, oh, 400 and something.
Yeah.
I was like, what?
Exactly. Exactly.
Oh, he was unstoppable, man. That guy was unstoppable.
Yeah. Well.
Still is, obviously. He's still going.
It's probably going to be like that guy in that movie I saw about moonshine runners that was like, he gets his throat slashed, and he, like, cheats death, and then in the end what does him in is he falls into an icy pond. He gets drunk and goes outside and falls into an icy pond and then dies of pneumonia.
I don't know what we'll get, Trevor. Probably someone will just annoy him and explode.
Yeah, well, maybe. Anyway, I'm not going to waste any more time by looking up this riddle, but... go ahead and tell us, Ben. You came up with a good topic this week.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking, you asked me for some feedback on a background, and I gave you some, and we were thinking about, like, I guess in your case, it was like remembering that you can have a bit of fun, but also I think it was, also inspired by the fact that I've been doing some study in 3D. You know, I've been doing 3D for a while now, and I thought, sometimes I'll be doing things and I'm like, this seems like harder than it needs to be. What am I missing? You know, so I went back and I did some beginner like tutorial videos on Blender, and I was like, oh wow, you know, I remember watching this video before and taking the knowledge, but it was so much knowledge that my brain couldn't take it all in. And now that I know the other stuff, I'm ready for the rest, if that makes sense.
I'm ready.
So I guess what I wanted to talk about was learning, but...
going back to basics! I don't know why I'm talking in this voice.
Yeah. Also in the light of relearning things, remembering things that you know but you forget, you know.
Yes.
Do you remember...
No.
We were in... Well, no, you don't remember much. But do you remember... and I'm not trying to call you out or anything here, but I think you'll understand why I'm bringing this up. We were at my aunt and uncle's place near Melbourne.
Mm.
And, you know, we were just...
Did you just say Melbourne?
Yeah.
Nice.
And we were just chilling out and doing a bit of sketching and stuff.
Yes.
And you drew...
I drew Edward Norton.
Yeah, that's right. And,
you said, why is his ear so high?
Yeah, I said, you know, remember, eyes and nose kind of define where the ears go.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of, and you reacted pretty strongly and you were like, oh man, I know that that's what you do. And for some reason I forgot.
Mm.
I kind of feel like that's a normal thing. There's so many things that we all know.
Yeah.
But forget to pay attention to in the act of trying to get stuff done. You know, you kind of need a mental checklist of like, all right, you know, I've got a friend who's been a roadie and a musician and a stage manager and a tour manager for decades and decades. He's an older guy.
Mm.
And
well, I would hope so if he's been one for decades and decades.
Right. We were working the same gig just before I flew over to visit you and everyone else in the US. And he was telling me that he was just about to head off. You know, we were sort of like, oh, what's your next thing after this? And he was saying that he was just off to the UK to play a bit of fill-in bass for Thin Lizzy.
Oh.
And, you know, I was talking about, he's a great bass player. He's filled in on bass for us before, and he's a great bass player, fantastic muso. And I said to him, you know, oh, you know, what's your prep for that? And he's like, oh, well, I usually go and get a bass lesson, like, at least once a year. I'm like, really?
Hmm.
You still get lessons?
Hmm.
Come on, dude. It was like, well, you never know what you don't know, you know?
That's true.
He said, it's always
good
to, like...
You never know what you don't know, you know?
You know? It was like, it's always a good idea to go back and, like, and let someone else watch you play, and they can go, hey, have you thought about this, or have you forgotten this?
Mm-hmm.
And, like, you know, assess the gaps in your technique. You know, and the other day, I was showing Ivan something that I was working on, and I was like, oh, you know, this is cool, and I'm pretty happy with how it's going, but not all of it. And he was like, oh, you should, these postures are really stiff, you should do contrapposto on them. And I'm like, why didn't I think of that? I know that's a thing. But I think what happens so many times in the act of trying to get stuff done and trying to think of, I mean, in the act of creating a single piece of art, there's so many things you end up paying attention to. Sometimes it's kind of hard to pay attention to individual elements, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, the ultimate goal is to just make something look good, but there's so many different facets that go into that. And it's the same with coding something. You know, you're just trying to make something work. There's so many different ways you can approach it or something like that. But yeah, and so it was funny for me to, like, go back to learning basic 3D stuff. And I mean really basic tutorials, like showing you the interface and stuff like that.
Mm.
And I still learned so much. And I was like, man, I should do this a lot more often, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, it was interesting to see you sort of, I guess, I'm trying to think how you worded it the other day, but we were talking about, you know, the ability to like, stop focusing on functional and
right.
have a bit of fun. And
yeah.
you're like, oh yeah, I kind of forgot that
mm-hmm.
in the, I guess, the act of trying to get things done.
Right. Well, I mean, I personally, so I guess we can tell the specific story of how this came about. So yeah, I was sketching a series of backgrounds for Rosewater, and I have two locations that I sketched, the exterior and the interior. Well, for easier purposes, let's call it exterior and interior. The first location is basically there's a wide establishing shot where you see the location in the distance, and then there's the second background is the close up of the exterior of the location, because
right.
at that
so it's
point
the same location, just at different camera
just
distances.
Different camera distances, yeah. And then the other one is just a very similar exterior of the other location, and then the other background is the interior, but that last one is irrelevant to this story. So anyway,
right.
I had drawn the exterior vista shot of the place, and I did it in one point perspective because I figured that would be the easiest way to do it, you know, just have the...
Sure, that's suitable.
Yeah, it's suitable. You know, it's a wide open exterior outdoor shot, so it's not like it's going to be too rigid or anything with the perspective. You know, I just wanted to have the building in the center, and so I concentrated on just making it look interesting. I did, you know, the whole rule of thirds thing. I put some interesting stuff around. I accidentally created a triangle, which you pointed out, and I said, oh, that was completely unintentional, but I'm glad that it's subconsciously in there. Anyway, my thinking was to vary it up a little bit for the exterior of this location. I thought, okay, well, I don't want to, since we're up close to it, and I don't want to just make it be, oh, well, here's just a close-up of the same thing that you're seeing. I wanted to mix it up, so I did it in two-point perspective. So there's a sort of, the building is on the right side of the background. It's at an angle because it's two-point perspective. And then there's this just sort of empty space in front of it because it's in a desert. And so in the background, you can still see the horizon and the mountains and the desert foliage and whatever. So I drew the background. And essentially, like, I added elements to it. I thought make it look interesting, you know, in that there's boarded up windows because it's an abandoned building. There's boarded up windows. There's a boarded up door. There's just like trash and stuff in the yard. But it just felt empty to me. And I thought,
right.
And I thought, you know, I want to focus on, even if it's just a background that only serves a purpose as an establishing shot or as just like the outside of a place, I still want it to be interesting to look at while you're playing it. I don't just want it to be functional. So I turned to you and I said, hey, do you have any suggestions for how to make this look more visually interesting? And you said, yes. And you came back to me and you did a little paint over and you added...
Sure. I asked a few questions to make sure I wasn't doing ideas that get in the way.
Right. So, so you asked me a few questions, I gave you some info, and then you came back with a paint over, and instantly, it was a lot more interesting. You added a water tower in the background, which I thought made complete sense, because, one, water towers are cool to look at, and two, this location is an abandoned building in the desert where someone would have spent a lot of time. It makes sense that they would have had a water tower to access water. So I was like, of course, why didn't I think of that? And then, you know, you added like a foreground fence post, which I love foreground objects, but up until now, the majority of the backgrounds that I have been doing that had foreground objects were interiors, because all the exterior shots were just of a town. And I couldn't, like, I think there's one that has a foreground, like, staircase banister in the very first shot. But I wasn't really thinking in terms of, like, oh, yeah, I want to have foreground objects. So, to me, it's a little bit more difficult to come up with good foreground objects for exterior shots. But, yeah, so you added a fence post, and you added, like, some hitching posts and stuff up against the wall to break it up. You suggested adding a stoop in front of the doors to just break up the line of the thing. And instantly it just became a lot more interesting to look at. And I thought, oh, well, that was actually very little that needed to be done to just amplify it. Mm-hmm. So I redid it. It looks a lot nicer. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And then I went and I looked at my sketch for the other exterior, which is the exterior of a fort. And it had a very similar composition as this previous background, except it was mirrored. So the fort was on the left side of the screen instead of the right side, but it was still two-point perspective, and the majority of the background was just the empty blank wall of the fort. And I had put like a little booth on the bottom left. Also, for reference, if you all want to see how this second background turned out, I tweeted it recently, so you can follow.
So they're both. Are they both on Twitter?
They're not. They're not. Just the second one. I tweeted the long shot. Although you can notice in the one I tweeted in the long shot, I went back and I added the stuff that had been. So like I added the water tower and I added the little hints of the fence posts and stuff. So that added a little bit more detail and made that one a little bit more interesting to look at too. But anyway, so I was looking at the background and I thought, okay, well, let me take what I just learned from the previous background and how do I make this more visually interesting? So I thought, okay, the majority of this wall is blank. I should add something to the wall to break it up so it's not so blank. So I added like a little, for lack of a better term, a sort of like shed type thing. Well, not really a shed. It's really more just like an awning with some like poles and some crates underneath. And that's up against the wall. And then I was like, okay, well, let me add a little like wall that runs perpendicular to the main wall and goes horizontally against the background to sort of separate the foreground bit from the background bit, because there's going to be stuff happening in the background. So I added a little wall and I made it broken, and I made a nice little gap in it. And so I was like, okay, well then, so I put a little, a broken wagon wheel leaning up against the wall. And then I thought, okay, well, what can I do as a foreground object? And I thought, well, all right, I'll put a cactus in. So immediately I was like, okay, this looks a lot cooler now. Like, this actually makes me want to look at this background. And that was the thing. So my main thing was, I think both, and I think this comes as a consequence of doing both the art and the design and everything, as opposed to you who are just, you know, your focus primarily is the art, is that I'm thinking in terms of, okay, well, what happens here? What is the puzzle here? What's the area of movement? Like, I'm thinking in terms of design. I'm like, all right, my initial thoughts are, okay, this has to be here. This is what's going to happen here. And I don't stop necessarily and think, oh, well, how can I make this artistically pleasing? Whereas that's your job. Your job is to take functional areas and turn them into interesting areas to look at. So
yeah, and I think it, like, it is harder when you're like, oh, this is the scene where we have to get past the door,
right,
to go to focus on other stuff. You know, and that's also a kind of tough scene. But I think one of the things in your case especially, you know, because I do this as well, you know, I'll draw a scene, you know, Dave will be like, oh, hey, I want you to draw this. And I'm like, ah, it's a door on a street. Come on, you right. know. So I have to stop myself and be like, all right, well, how can a door on a street be cool?
Right.
How can it be interesting? Because I don't necessarily find cities that interesting. I'm not a city person. And I sort of, you know, to me, cities, buildings are buildings, you know. I'm not. Hmm. I'm trying to focus more on architecture and stuff, but to me, it's a...
Well, I mean, I feel like there's plenty of ways focusing on architecture and things like that to make doors. You can make doors interesting.
Absolutely.
I mean,
that's not my focus. And
no, of course.
I'm still at focusing right on that. So I have to make myself think about it if I want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in your case, you know, you're doing an old Western kind of setting.
Right.
There's so many interesting things to my, I mean, I'm an outdoors, you know, rural setting kind of guy.
Right.
So I instantly think, oh, that's interesting. Oh, that's cool. You know, when I look at paintings, those sort of paintings strike me first.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's some of it. But also, like you say, you're going in with that design in your head. Of course, you're going to be like, oh, well, I've got to draw the door because that's what happens.
Right.
But I think it's important to think beyond nouns and verbs, and start to think of adjectives and adverbs if you must, you know. It's a little harder to do that, but that's an animation thing. But, you know, I think it really is helpful to add those adjectives to your nouns. You know, yeah, you've got a door, but is it, what sort of door is it, you know? Yeah, you've got a hallway, but what sort of hallway is it? And I think when you think about the old games, or the games that inspired you to draw, or the things that inspired you to draw, whether they be animated television or paintings or, you know, comic books or whatever, if you look past the surface thing, you know, like, oh, you know, Sam and Max was colourful, or Day of the Tentacle was wonky. If you actually look at the details that they put in there and you know, try and think about why, it's not that easy. And then go, right, well, I can do that too. I'm an artist, you know. Mm. And I think that's one of those things where you can step back and be like, all right, I've thought about perspective. I've thought about, you know, color balance. I've thought about all of these different things. Now it's just time to think about making it cool,
mm-hmm.
which seems much less complex and technical, but it's just as important, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's also the danger of filling up the screen with too much interesting stuff, yeah, which then could distract players. But yeah,
I disagree with that. Like, not to pick on you again, but you know, the other day when I sent you my sketch, one of the things that I sketched in there was a flag, and right. you're like, "Oh, I didn't put the flag in because I'm saving the flag for this other scene." And I'm like, "Dude, there's flags everywhere. You live in America, especially there's flags everywhere in America, dude. How is a flag one of your most interesting things that you think it's worth saving for another thing? Surely you can think of more interesting elements to add to your background than
well,
a flag."
One. This is not actually America. It's an alternate history. So they're not quite as patriotic.
Are you making a Western?
Yeah, I'm making a Western,
then
but it's
American.
Yeah, but it's set in Vespuccia, which is still technically, I mean, not technically, it's still under British rule. So they're not going to be like, look, we're independent. We got our own flag. It's basically right. Australia. Or
well, we got lots of flags.
Yeah, well, anyway, but
we
the other
misguided national pride.
Yes, but there's two reasons that I saved the flag. One was because I felt, yeah, it's in a fort, and the first of all, this building is a secret clandestine operation. I don't think the person inside would have felt national pride. And second, it means I would have had to animate two flags, and I only want to animate one flag. So
oh, hang on, let me fetch something that I may mop up your tears. I understand. Yes. Yeah, that's one of those things. Like if you look at the more detailed scenes in Shardlight, I'm just like, I'll just go nuts.
Well, and yes,
no one's gonna look at a flag and be like, ooh, is that what I need to do to solve my quest?
No. Well, but that's a very specific example. I can point out two specific examples. Let's use Shardlight. Did go crazy in Shardlight, and there was a lot of scenes where, in order to sort of emphasize the ruin and the decay, there was a bunch of scenes that had hanging wires and ropes and things like that.
I'm a sucker for a dangly cable.
Yes.
That's one of my many go-tos.
I know, and as a result, I noticed that a lot of players, there was a couple of puzzles that required you to have rope, and a lot of players were like, there's rope everywhere! Why can't I pick any of this rope up?
Well, let them pick
and,
it up.
Yeah, well, that makes it a lot more complicated, but that's well, because you'd have to draw all of the rope there and not. But anyway, that's sort of a thing that where there needs to be, that's an example we can talk about, or we've talked about communication between artist and designer where,
sure.
you know, but I can think of as an example that you've talked about from Unavowed, the scene outside the back of the house in the Bronx where you have to throw the brick through the window. You had added a weed whacker or something, I think.
A lawnmower.
Yeah, and Dave asked you to remove it because players were confused and they thought that they needed to pick up the lawnmower. So you can add little details for emphasis like that, but a lot of times it might actually be distracting and counterproductive to
sure,
your gameplay.
That doesn't mean you just don't put it. That means you find something else to put in, I think.
Well, yeah.
For me, anyway.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's stuff like that.
But anyway, like, yeah, we were talking about going and learning things. Because one thing I wanted to say was, I don't think that you or I do this. In fact, I think we're pretty much the opposite of this. And I mean, there's the whole thing about never rest, you know, because you're never really done. You're never done learning. We've said this before. And there's really no reason to think that just because you feel like you've gotten good or good enough at something that you shouldn't go back and try and approach something like you're a beginner. Like, I still don't think I'm particularly good at drawing faces. I mean, I feel like I got a lot of practice on Lamplight City, and, you know, I made things look as good as I could, but I'm in no way, shape, or form any good at drawing faces. I'm not doing portraits for Rosewater, so I thought, well, I don't need to really learn. But I saw a book recently that was called You Will Learn How to Draw Faces by the End of This Book, and I thought, okay, I'm going to get this book because, I mean, I haven't really used it yet, but I want to practice.
You've had it for 3 days.
It for 3 days, and the glue already came off the back, so I was angry about
dear.
That. Yeah. That's probably why it was so cheap. But I bought it because I was, part of me, I was like, oh, I don't really need to do this because I'm not doing portraits in Rosewater. But then I thought, no, I should. I should practice on my off time because it's never too early to start practicing, even if I'm not going to use it necessarily practically for anything. It's always good to hone your skills and to get better and stuff. And I definitely need practice. And this book in particular, I feel, is, I mean, it's really more of a sketchbook with instructions in it because it has lots of blank pages and blank spaces for you to practice in, which is fine.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, it's the same thing with you. You know, you've been doing 3D for a while, but you still don't feel, you've told me you don't feel like you've mastered 3D. I mean, no one has mastered 3D. So it's always good to go back and check stuff. Like, yeah, it's always good to go back and remember what perspective is and what everything else is. And just, if you think that you've gotten good at something, whether it be writing or art or design or whatever, it's important to go back and read stuff about it. Like I did recently, too. I read two books by Robert McKee about, one was about story and the other one was about dialogue. And even though they had more of a cinematic slant to them, they had some useful tips. And actually, a lot of the stuff in the dialogue book I found was really good. I mean, it was adapted very well by John Ingold in his talk that he gave at Adventure X last year about writing sparkling dialogue, and that bit in particular where he breaks down the scene in Blade Runner and he's talking about the beats and like how the power dynamic shifts in the scene and stuff. There was a lot of that in the dialogue book. And
that's cool.
Yeah, and but of course, like I said, it's cinema based, so it doesn't factor in interaction, which John did a great job of talking about. And if you haven't seen the talk, I highly recommend checking it out on YouTube. I think it's called Writing Sparkling Dialogue or something like that. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It got a lot of attention and deservedly so because, yeah. And so I took that advice and I was like, okay, well, I'm going to approach how I write dialogue a little differently now and how I structure conversations differently now, because it's true. In most adventure game conversations, actually, there was a pretty good talk about this at Neuroscope too. I'm not sure if it was recorded, but it talked about how dialogue systems haven't really changed much in 30 years since Monkey Island, and
right.
How, you know, you basically get this laundry list and most games just have you click through them all, and that's not how real conversations work. Like, if you say one particular thing, it might lead you down a completely different conversational path, and you might not necessarily get the chance to go back and talk about the other subjects because of time or something happens or whatever. And you know, if you pick an option that might make the person you're talking to upset with you and want to end the conversation prematurely, or maybe they won't open up as much to you, that sort of thing. Branching conversations,
right.
Basically.
And
right, how to do them dynamically and more interestingly. And yeah, so that's been something that I've really been thinking about and trying to implement. And it's just another thing. Like,
And I feel like you've been writing dialogue for so long within that set of limitations or systems or whatever you want, mechanics, if that's what you want to call it.
Yeah, and even
there's
still...
there's no reason you can't go back and be like, all right, well, I've been doing this way forever.
Exactly. I mean,
reassess.
I've been writing dialogue on the fly within the AGS editor my entire game-making career. This time around, mm-hmm. I'm writing out all my dialogue on paper first before plugging
right.
it in. So yeah, even just doing something like that to mix it up helps, I think.
I think, do you remember a few years ago, I went and looked at every Full Throttle scene mm-hmm. and tried to apply the knowledge that I'd gained from reading, you know, the writings of other artists, from drawing and, you know, from reading forum posts and stuff like that. I tried to apply everything to those.
Mm-hmm.
It was really interesting to me to see, like, I feel like people know that I've been inspired by Full Throttle. We only have to look at, you know, stuff that I've drawn a bit. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I hadn't really looked at those scenes the same way that I looked at them doing that. And I went, oh, man, there's so much stuff in here that I missed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I feel like it's hard to figure out what makes something good on the first go. And I'm not saying that all that theory was conscious or anything like that. I merely feel like those people have instincts which push them in those directions or, you know, stuff like that, right?
Mm.
And to go back and look at scenes that I knew all those scenes. Come on. I know that game, right? But that doesn't mean you can't learn anything from looking at them again.
Yeah.
You know, and I think also looking at your own work and being aware of your weaknesses and looking at your current work and going, have I still made those mistakes? Do I still do that? You know, because, I mean, I've learned a lot, but I haven't changed how I draw.
Right.
I'm still Ben Chanley. Like, you can look at stuff that I drew 10 years ago and look at stuff that I drew today and still see it's the same guy.
Mm-hmm.
I just have more patience now and a bit more technical knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and on the opposite side of the coin, you can also... if you learn stuff, you can go back and look at stuff. And I don't mean this to pick on this particular game, but you can go back and look at a game that has backgrounds that at one point you were like, wow, these are really nice. And then when you have more of an appreciation or knowledge of technical stuff, you can see that maybe they're more flawed than you originally thought.
Absolutely.
I
look at my old games and I'm like, I hardly started those backgrounds, let alone finished them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was going to say in the original Broken Sword, like, I always thought those backgrounds were gorgeous. And they still are. A lot of them are really nice, but a lot of them make some really interesting choices when it comes to perspective.
Yeah, and there's a lot of perspective issues in that game and other issues that are interesting.
Yeah, but it doesn't detract. I mean, it's still a very nice looking game. Well, it's just once you realize, you're like, oh, well, okay, then.
I think it's also kind of comforting.
Yeah,
to look at the work of someone that maybe you considered a master, or that, you know, I think when I started drawing pictures, I had no idea how pictures were drawn.
Mm-hmm.
I thought you just pick up a pen and just start drawing and eventually a picture comes out, right?
You mean that's not how it works?
Well.
What have I been doing with my life?
But yeah, and it's interesting to like, to be like, if I told you in 1999, hey, I want you to draw a background that looks like, you know, who do I want to pick on? I don't know.
Everyone.
Yeah, but if I said, you know, draw a background that looks like, you know, a Grimshaw painting. Let's take an easy go-to, because someone that you'd... In 1999, you wouldn't have known what to do.
Hell no.
You would have just been like...
I didn't even know who Grimshaw was at night. Well, I didn't know Grimshaw was until, like, 2012, to be fair.
Sure.
But
you see what I'm saying, right?
Yeah.
Whereas now, if 12. I said to you...
We're like 16. Anyway, please go ahead.
Now, if I said to you, uh-huh, you know, try and do a Grimshaw painting,
yes,
you'd be like, oh, well, I'll start here, I'll start there. You can look at his painting, yes, and see the things that he does differently.
By the way... I know,
apply your techniques.
I'm sure I've said this to you before, and I may have even said it on the podcast, but it greatly amuses me that in James Gurney's book, Color and Light, there is a bit where there's a section on night lighting, and there's a painting that he's done that is obviously a ripoff of John Atkinson Grimshaw's Leeds Cathedral painting that I have hanging in my bathroom. Like, there's no question at all that he was totally going for that. And, like, it's some place in, like, upstate New York or something, which makes sense because the architecture and the churches are fairly similar to, like, you know, the UK and stuff. But he does a really good job of emulating Grimshaw, and he doesn't mention it at all, which, I mean, that's fine, but it's just funny to me that he's just like, yep, here's the how do you do night lighting, and he's just like, well, there's my Grimshaw. So
yeah, I mean,
yeah.
I don't know, but you know, that's something that, like, that interests me, is that once you gain some abilities, you can go back and look at the stuff that inspired you.
Sure.
And be like, all right, what did they do that I don't do? Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yes. Although sometimes you can look at something for hours and try and figure out how they did something, and it just doesn't come.
Oh, sure. That's
I've been trying to figure out how Grimshaw did his clouds forever, and I still can't quite get it.
Dude, I was looking at JC Landecker the other day. Yeah. There's no way I'm ever going to be able to emulate that dude, but you know, it's fun to look.
Yeah. Yeah, but James Gurney did it, and I'm like, fuck. I mean, James Gurney's a great artist, of course.
And also, he's a very studied artist. You know,
yeah.
he got taught how to paint backgrounds by everyone's favorite, Thomas Kinkade, and like...
Wait, really?
Know, yeah, and...
Oh!
Well, Gurney sketched a lot, right?
Right.
And, they would... he and Tom Kinkade sold themselves...
Don't call him Tom.
...as a background painting duo to get the gig on Ice and Fire, or Fire and Ice, or whatever that Ralph Bakshi movie was.
Right.
And so, you know, and then they got the gig, and Gurney's like, oh man, I can draw, but I can't paint. So Kinkade showed him how to paint.
Oh my God.
And I feel like if you look at Dinotopia and stuff like that, you can see Kincaid's influence.
I just looked up Thomas Kinkade, and I think I knew this already, but I had forgotten it. He has the same birthday as me.
Well,
different year, obviously, but same day.
I think Kinkade's a great painter.
Mm.
I realize that all of his stuff is really, really kitschy, but I think he's a great painter.
Mm.
Anyway,
yeah.
None of that is really that relevant.
What I'm trying to say is
that in studying those works, and you know, and you can see in the writings of like James Gurney and you know, other people that were inspired, is, you know, Gurney did a study of Norman Rockwell. He did a study of Landecker. He did studies of all of these people, because that's how you learn.
Mm.
And like going back to the basics, and like, you know, my art teacher in high school gave me two rules. One of them is don't copy other artists. That's a terrible rule, and I now break that all the time. And the other one was never erase anything you've drawn. That's also a terrible rule, and I break that all the time now.
Mm.
So, you know, I mean, maybe that works for some artists. It doesn't work for me.
Can I just interrupt to read an amusing couple of anecdotes about Thomas Kinkade?
Is it about him peeing into the Disney fountain? Because everyone knows that.
Yeah, well... sort of, yes.
Oh, come on, everyone knows that dude.
Okay, fine. He also got drunk at a Siegfried and Roy show and started shouting, codpiece, codpiece. Eventually, he was calmed by his mother. Have I ever... By the way, speaking of controversial, kitschy artists, let's talk about Jeff Koons for a second. Do you know Jeff Koons?
The name's familiar, but I can't, like, no picture comes to mind when you say that name. So,
well, Jeff Koons is he's a kitsch artist. He's most famous for doing, like, silver sculptures of, like, Michael Jackson's chimp and...
Oh, right.
He had a series of photographs where he basically took a bunch of photos of himself having sex with his wife, who was an Italian porn star, and... they're just like really big and very explicit, and it's like, how is this art? But I want to read you this, because this is on Jeff Koons's Wikipedia page, and this is like probably one of my favorite things that I've ever read about an artist. because it's just so appropriate for Jeff Koons. And forgive me, listeners, but I want you to learn this little bit about Jeff Koons. So the Wikipedia article, and of course it's Wikipedia, so take it with a grain of salt, but I really want it to be true.
Okay.
Around 1990, Koons lived in New York in a full-service hotel near Wall Street. During that time, he did not have a studio. In 1991, he married Hungarian-born naturalized Italian pornography star Cicciolina, whose real name is Ilona Staller, who for 5 years, from 1987 to 1992, pursued an alternate career as a member of the Italian parliament. So already this is interesting because we have a porn star who's also a politician. After seeing her picture in two European magazines, Koons had flown to Rome, watched her perform, and gone backstage to suggest that they collaborate on what he then thought would be a movie. She agreed. A series of strenuous photographic sessions became the basis for the Made in Heaven paintings and sculptures in various media. The movie never got made, but Koons and Staller fell in love. Now, this is where it gets good. He courted her through an interpreter. She spoke very little English, and Koons, who spoke about 4 words of Italian, kept trying to communicate directly by speaking English with an Italian accent. The interpreter had to be let go because she fell in love with Koons.
And his Italian accent. You can't, a man with an Italian accent, even if he doesn't speak Italian, that's very alluring.
This is just a movie waiting to be made. He's like, hello, how are you? My name is Jeff. And the interpreter's like, oh, he's so dreamy.
What a man. That's the guy for me.
I know. And then they had a son named Ludwig.
And then
their marriage.
This podcast now is now enamored with you because of that.
Oh boy! And then
this is what's happened.
Well, wait, it gets ugly because they got married. They had a son in 1992, and shortly after their marriage ended, amid allegations that Koons had subjected Staller to physical and emotional abuse. So yeah,
this is a happy podcast.
Yep. Anyway, this lady, she offered publicly to have sex with Saddam Hussein in exchange for his releasing foreigners held in Iraq. Well, bunch of interesting people in this sordid affair.
Has certainly shifted tone.
Well, I mean, you know, you came for the talk about adventure games, and now you learn a little something extra from the bowels of Wikipedia. Yes,
yeah, a little bit about the world.
We're here to help, anyway.
But yeah, what I was. I've kind of lost my place, but what I was basically saying is like
I think we lost our place like 112 episodes ago.
Well, yeah. But yeah, I've been interested, you know, the projects I'm working on now are very different, and you know, they've presented their share of challenges and everything, and it's going okay, you know, they're going okay, we're working through the challenges, there have been good days and bad days, but there's that with every project. But what I'm finding is that I have to, and also am allowed to, readjust my expectations of what I'm allowed to do, what I can do. And it's cool to, like, you know, now when I play a 3D game, I look at it differently. And now when I play something like Sunless Skies, for example, I look at it differently. And it's really interesting to me to see how I look at things changes depending on what I'm working on. And I think that lets you, like, go back and play something or view something that you really liked or really didn't like. And maybe you can see that a game that you thought looked terrible actually had a lot of work put into it, or, you know, it's really interesting to me how, like, you can go back and you can look at not just your old work or whatever, but, like, you know, I look at 3D art now I don't know when I played some of the stuff that I look at. Some was 10 years ago, some was 20 years ago. And I'm like, that's how that works, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty empowering. But also, if you don't take the time to go back and look at that stuff, you're trying to solve a lot of problems by yourself. And, you know, I think like, if we... Well, it's the whole point of why I was looking at Full Throttle a couple of years ago. I learned so much from doing that I'm, like, empowered just by looking at someone who's a better artist than me and like how he approaches problems. Nobody puts more interesting elements into a background than Peter Chan. Peter Chan can make a brick and a pillar look interesting, let alone, you know. And if you look at the stuff from Full Throttle, I always go to Full Throttle because they're the images I can picture the most vividly in my head. If you go and look at how that man did a wall with a door in it, you can see so much texture. You know, Peter Chan never just did a wall. That wall had different sections, different materials, different colors, different patterns, different directions in the patterns. It was never just a wall.
Right.
And, you know, I think we can all learn from someone that found walls interesting enough to make them look cool. Not just look good, not just look realistic, but make them look cool. You know, and I think that's something that I forget and something that you forget, is that a wall's allowed to be cool.
Well, sure. I mean, that's the main challenge, is if you know, 60% or 70% of your background is a wall, how do you make that wall look interesting and or cool? That's
Yeah, and I think one of the interesting things is being aware of the fact that, hey, my wall's not very cool.
Right.
Right, and having that awareness is the first step of being like, you know, or like looking at a posture that I did, you know, and I was focused on making the outfit look cool, of making the character's face look cool, of making their, you know, their makeup, whatever, their hair look cool. I didn't even think about the pose. I was just like trying to draw a realistic pose. Realistic isn't interesting. No. I see realistic every day, you know. And it's interesting to stop and step back and go, right, okay, make it cool.
Yeah.
Make it, you know, and what have I missed? That's on a really basic level. But think about it. And I also want to say, and I don't do this enough, and you don't do this enough, and none of the artists I know do this enough. If you do a lot of different versions of a thing, it'll get better and better every time.
But that requires work.
Yeah, I know. It's terrible.
I know.
You know, all of the artists that I really admire, they don't go with their first sketch.
Right.
And it frustrates me that I do. And, you know, we've got time limits. We've got deadlines, as it were.
I think when you say all your favorite artists, are you talking about your favorite artists that work in games or just artists in general?
Well,
or both.
Well, both, yeah.
Okay.
People that create illustrations, the most technically proficient, they never go with option number one.
Right.
Because the best writers that I know never go with option number one either. They write their first draft.
Oh, sure.
They refine it to a second draft, you know.
Yeah.
And I think...
I kind of feel like game art is... The only instance I can think of off the top of my head where I know for a fact that the artist sketched something and then redid it was Bill Tiller for Curse of Monkey Island, but that was because of the process of creating the backgrounds was such that he had to draw a thumbnail and then like draw the background and then resize it and then ink it and then all that stuff.
But I mean, even in the thumbnails stage, why are you doing one? Why am I doing one thumbnail?
Right. Well, I don't even do a thumbnail. I just sketch a background and then I might modify my sketch later on, but
it's such a weird thing to think about, isn't it?
Yeah, it kind of is. But at the same time, I'm like, I can't fathom drawing a full, well, obviously not, you wouldn't have to draw a full background, but I can't really think of just like doing a thumbnail sketch. I guess if I was looking for color or something, but I don't know. Generally what I do is like, if all of the backgrounds in a particular set are going to share like a common color scheme or whatever, I'll spend a lot of time figuring that out in the first background I draw and then just already have that, not template, but that idea for the next one. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it does, and I do the same thing.
I mean, usually what I do is once I do my sketch and I lay out my colors, I'll just, like, figure out the light sources, and then once I figured out the light sources, then I go in and I make the necessary adjustments to like the coloring or the lighting or the shading or whatever. Like if it's a wall, if it's a blank wall and I put in the light source, then I'm like, okay, well now I know where the light's coming from. I'm going to go in and make this wall, give this wall lighting texture or whatever. But as far as like the basics of the sketch, you know, so for rooms and stuff, like maybe the positioning or the type of objects or stuff might change. But it's never something so drastic as like, oh, well, this is a completely different reimagining. Actually, I just remembered. I saw that Backwoods Entertainment recently tweeted a thing where they posted four pictures in a row of the iteration of the bedroom for the main character in Unforeseen Incidents. And the very first one had this very like Curse of Monkey Island vibe to it. And stylistically, it didn't change much, but the color scheme did.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really interesting to see. So look that up if you want to see an example of that. But like they drew the background like four different times, and I can't imagine doing that.
Some people, that's their starting point. It's right. Like, oh yeah, draw the thing. And I will say, I've done this where I've like said to myself, right, all right, do 9 thumbnails of a thing. And I do 9 thumbnails. And, you know, if you look in my sketchbook, you know, sometimes I'll be like, well, do 6 versions of this. And once you've done those 6 versions, do another 6, but change them more. Mm-hmm. What aren't you changing? And they get better and better.
Mm-hmm.
If not better and better, at least more experimental, more creative. The first thing that you draw will probably be the thing that you think will look good, which is usually the safe, like, option. And I think, like, you know, all the technical abilities aside, all of the stuff that you've learned over the years, if you ignore all of that and you just go back to the real, like, starting point of, like, hey, let's experiment.
Mm-hmm.
The amount of improvement that you can gain is remarkable. You know, and it frustrates me that I don't do this more. I know I should do it. I just, you know, don't make it an active part of my workday enough, unfortunately.
Mm.
You know, but it's interesting now doing Nighthawks. If Dave asked me to draw something, I basically know what Dave wants because I came to Dave's games knowing what Dave's games look like, right? So I was trying to take Dave's backgrounds and just put different colors into them. Colors is what I like working with. Colors is what I'm good at mixing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm better at colors than perspective. I'm better at colors than people. I'm better at colors than basically material rendering or anything else, you know. That's what I'm best at and most comfortable with. But now that I'm working with Richard, you know, and we're doing a totally different kind of game, I often have no idea what a scene has to look like. And it's really interesting to me to, like, you know, often what I'll do is I'll mock something up in 3D, like a rough thing, and I'll send it to him. And he'll be like, oh no, that's not right at all. Can we do this? Can we do that? And we basically always end up with something that we both really like. But the process is so different for me now. It's really interesting. And I'm way happier with some of the stuff that I'm drawing at the moment than I have been with, you know, backgrounds in Out of Vow that I'm like, I know this is a fine looking background. You know, I know this looks good.
Mm-hmm.
But it's nothing that I haven't drawn before. You know, it's a street with a door.
Right.
I didn't push myself to make the street with a door interesting. And yeah, it's really... It's interesting how redefining what my approach through the necessity of not having that safety net of, oh, I know what Dave's games look like, has really pushed me. And I'm like, oh, man, I wish that I had this years ago. I mean, it's also been hard because, you know, there's sometimes I'm like, I honestly don't know what you want. I don't know what I'm meant to be doing here, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's interesting. But, I do think that you know, my very baseline of what I have to do has changed, and I can't just take the easy road anymore, and that really has helped me.
That's good.
Yeah, it is good. It is good. It's a terrible thing, but you do get stuck in a rut, and you do get comfortable, and you do think, oh, yeah, this is how I draw, so that's how I'm going to draw again, you know. And
this
you
is how I draw, this is how I write, this is how I code.
This is, you know, you approach a problem with a solution in mind already without testing other solutions, and that's not going to push you, I guess.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah,
yeah, it's because yeah, you get stuck in the rut, and yeah, then you end up just making the same mistakes or just doing the same thing over and over again.
And I think it's kind of shocking, it's kind of educating, and it's also kind of devastating when you know what adventure games look like, and so you draw them that way, and then someone comes along
right.
that draws them totally differently, and you're like, oh man, why didn't I think to do it like that?
Right.
You know, those moments are always the moments when I'm like, oh man, adventure games can be this, and I didn't even know they could be that. Those moments are the moments when I've improved the most.
Yeah. It's interesting, too, because you mentioned earlier, this is just a little side thing, but you were saying about how your particular style, like, oh, that's Ben Chandler drew that. And mm-hmm. I've talked about this before. Like, I've never really thought of myself as having a particularly identifiable style. Because I feel
absolutely do.
Yeah, so I guess I do. But it was interesting. It was interesting to me. Yeah, like there was a post on the forums a while back where Snarky was like, "Oh yeah, look, there's." I think he posted a screenshot from one of the Ben Jordans, one from A Golden Wake, and one from Lamplight City, and then one from Rosewater. And he's like, "These all, or maybe not that many, but a few." But he was like, you know, there's improvement here, but you can still tell that it's the same artist. And I was like, yes. Well, that's nice. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, which, my stuff's the same, man.
Which is good. That's what which is what I'm saying. Like, I think also, I don't know if there's like an inherent fear that if you try and push yourself, then you won't be recognizable anymore. But I think it's just, you're always going to look like your stuff.
Yeah, I will make you this promise, is that you will never be able to escape how you draw.
Which is fine. I don't want to, necessarily.
Because the way that you draw is a collection of inspirations that has spanned 37 years, right?
Right.
Well, maybe not the first three, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. But, so it's like, if you keep making the same, like, if I were to keep drawing the same way that I drew, you know, like when I was doing my tracing over photos for Ben Jordan 5, if I had kept that up, my games would look, well, they wouldn't look good. But what am I trying to say here? I'm trying to say that, you know, you'll basically just keep making the same product over and over again if you don't push yourself.
Yeah.
And some people might like that. But a lot of people will get tired of it and move on.
I think
it's always important to just try and do something different, whether it's a small thing, like, you know, just using different colors or whatever.
You will not lose your style. You know, you look at, like, Dropsy and Hypnospace Outlaw, they're totally different looking. They're totally different styles of games, but you can tell they come from the same person.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, like, I recently posted a 3D picture that I'd done for my studies in a Discord, and our friend Christopher, Lost Train Dude, as AGSers probably know him, said to me, he said, no matter what the tools, you always seem to get it looking like one of your pictures. And it's true, because when I pick the colors for a 3D picture, I still have the same favorite colors. I still have the same favorite shades of light. I don't become someone else. You know, I still have the same favorite proportions.
Right.
So I think, like, the fear that you won't look like yourself anymore is not just naive, but also an unnecessary restriction on yourself.
Well, I mean, I'm just speculating that that's a thing. I don't know if that's actually a thing.
Right.
But yeah,
and I mean, there's particular people when, you know, I remember at one point I used to play Dave's games before I knew you very well. Where I'd be like, oh, spot Francisco Gonzalez, you know, and you'd be doing different voices, but I still know your voice.
Sure.
You know, and there's particular actors and people that you've probably met and got very familiar with their work. Well, no matter what they do, you'll pick their voice. It's the same with art.
Well, that's actually, to go off on another tangent, that's actually interesting. Yeah, there are some voice actors who are better at disguising their voice than others, but... Mm-hmm. But the thing, I remember when I did my commercial demo reel and I came in my first session with Shelley, she asked me to prepare questions for her or just kind of to figure out what I wanted to work on or what I wanted to do. Right. And one of the things I said was, I want to be able to not sound like me every time. And she said, but that's not what you want. You want to be able to sound like you. You just want to sound like different different aspects of you.
Right.
Which maybe right. is different for commercial than it is for animation. But, you know, for example, in my commercial demo reel, I have one commercial that's like a middle of the road sort of like, well, not even middle of the road, but I have one that's just like, you know, it's for a portable life tracker and it's like, it's a little bit more high energy, like, yeah, hey, whatever. And then there's a toy commercial that's like super high energy. And mm-hmm. then there's like a sexy one for clothes that's a little bit lower. And then there's one that's just like, you know, conversational, relaxed coffee type thing. And I forget what else. But, there's like a cartoon one. Or not a cartoon one, but there's like a comedy one about like shampoo and pitchforks and a witch.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't trying to disguise my voice. I was just trying to do different things. And the funny thing is, every time I play my commercial demo reel for somebody, or every time I would play a spot for them, the immediate response was, that sounds nothing like you. And I always thought that was really interesting. Because I think that's the thing too with voice acting. Like, yeah, you can try and disguise your voice, but I think the important thing isn't so much that you're disguising your voice. I think it's just that you're sounding believable as this character. And yeah, I mean, like, you know, you can have that little moment of, oh, haha, hi, so-and-so, I recognize you. But if you get past that and you just are like, oh, okay, this is the character, instead of just the whole time being like, oh, that's so-and-so, that's what's important. Because, I mean, there's certain voice actors that, like, yeah, they always sound the same, like Nolan North, for example. I mean, his Nathan Drake sounds just like his Prince from Prince of Persia, sounds just like Desmond Miles from Assassin's Creed. But, I mean, I always move past that. It fits.
Yeah, and I don't think it matters. And I think, like,
As opposed to somebody like, what's his name? The guy who played Joel in The Last of Us. And he's, like, in everything. He's the opposite of Nolan North. He played his brother in Uncharted 4. Oh, God, what's his name?
I haven't played The Last of Us or Uncharted 4, so...
Yeah, but this guy... Well, anyway, I'm sure it's going to come to me and I'm going to kick myself.
You'll say it and I'll be like, oh, yeah, that guy.
Yeah, but anyway, he's a chameleon. Like, his voice changes constantly, yet he always kind of sounds similar.
Okay. I mean, I feel like it's the same for art. I feel like it's the same for writing. I feel like it's the same for design. Like, you know, you might be writing a Western now, but it's still going to be the same guy that, you know, you can't hide your voice as a writer that easily. The things that amused you before are still going to amuse you in a Western setting. You know, the things that you find important and dramatic,
sure.
The way that you handle pacing and tone and stuff like that are still going to be the same.
Yeah.
You know,
it's Troy Baker, by the way.
Right. I do know that name.
Yes.
And it's one of those things where, like, if you draw something, you still want to draw something the same, with the same sense ability that makes your stuff powerful, whether you're doing a comedy or a drama, but you're not going to draw them the same way.
You're right, I mean...
different aspects of yourself.
Yeah, you're not going to tell the same story every single time because that's just formulaic, but, like... You know.
Well, some of us can't help it.
Well, yeah. But, I mean, that's another trick entirely, is avoiding being formulaic. But, like, you know, you want to vary it up. You still want to elicit the same emotions or reactions or whatever from people,
just in different
ways.
Yeah, the stuff that was important to you in a comedy is probably still important to you in a drama.
Yeah.
Or a horror or whatever.
Right.
You know? I can tell a David Gilbert joke from a million miles away.
Right.
You know.
Because it's a dad joke, probably.
Well, yeah, but I make dad jokes too, you know.
Oh, yeah, so do I.
it's the same with you, right? I can play your games and be like, oh yeah, that's a Francisco Gonzalez bit.
Mm.
And that's good. Mm. You know, when I read a Discworld novel, I want it to read like a Discworld novel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and yeah, I think it's, they're all about different things. They all come across with different tones, but they're all written by the same guy. They're all written with the same, I guess, worldview is what I'm trying to say.
Yes. Well, you've started talking about Discworld, so that's usually a good point to...
Time to
wrap things up. And I also feel like we went all over the place, but I hope we basically covered what we set out to. Anyway, that's our podcast. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much, everybody, for listening.
Yes.
We've missed you. I've missed doing this.
Yeah, I have too. I have too. Yeah. That's good. That's a good sign. Before we go, I just want to plug a little something.
Sure.
It's today, as of this recording, it's July 5th. On Saturday, July 13th, that's a week from tomorrow, or a week from when this podcast releases. That's not, released is not a word. I will be participating in a stream marathon for charity. The YouTube Adventure Roundtable, which is a little group of people who like adventure games, will be having an 18-hour marathon stream.
It's for a good cause.
Yeah, it's for Able Gamers, which is a charity that helps disabled people play games. And so it's going to be a charity stream, 2-hour blocks per streamer. My block is going to be from 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And I will be streaming The Curse of Monkey Island. We will all be streaming one of our favorite games, and that is one of mine. So I will be streaming The Curse of Monkey Island. You are more than welcome, Ben, to attend, although it's fairly early in the morning for you, so I don't know if you want to. But
I appreciate your invitation to be your...
If you feel like doing Bela Lugosi voices at 4 o'clock in the morning...
I am always ready.
Then...
pull the string of the banjo.
Pull the string, yes. So yeah, that's happening. So if you want to tune in, not just to my stream, I believe it starts... what time does it start? That's a good question. It starts early in the morning, and it starts
peeling the skin off my back in anticipation.
Anyway,
that's relevant.
Yes, it is. So yeah, watch, donate if you want. And yeah, that should be some fun. So check it out.
Have you got games on sale in the Steam sale at the moment?
Oh yeah, but that ends in like 4 days. Who cares? Lamplight City is on sale for 20% off, but it's gonna go on sale again like a week after that. So
sites have so many sales these days.
I know they do, and it's all about wishlist conversions. And don't even get me started on the Indiepocalypse.
Sounds like a businessman.
It's so bad. It's so bad. Yeah. Anyway, on that depression aside, follow us on Twitter. I'm at Grunislav Games.
I'm at Ben_304.
And together we are at BCT _ podcast. Well, good. See you next year. Bye.